Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Tuesday Night Discussion Group. We'll be discussing Steve Ozenich's The Great Pain Deception again this week, chapters 32 and 33, Power Therapies and Laugh, Damn It, Seriously. These are some good chapters. Again, another powerful week. We got some good people that's going to be listening in tonight, and we welcome you all, and we appreciate you being here. And we just want to give the, go ahead and, before we start, I do need to let everyone know that this is a peer support group. None of us are medical or mental health professionals. If you have a medical concern, you should see a properly licensed physician or a TMS physician. Okay? And that'll be it. And Bruce, you got it, buddy.
Okay, so tonight we're going to be covering two chapters, as Herbie said, 32, Power Therapies, and Laugh, Damn It, Seriously, Chapter 33 of Steve Ozenich's The Great Pain Deception, 2011. And the first chapter is on power therapies, and I'm going to rely on Herbie's intimate knowledge of all of these, since mine is based largely on wiki and anecdote. But according to Steve, power therapies walk the individual through the trauma to discharge a freeze response that was never released. He says, to simplify it, that they heal broken hearts. He says they often deal with meridian points or the chi or energy fields that are aimed at working through or redirecting pain from the mind. They are labeled power therapies because of the speed and effect they supposedly have on reducing or diffusing the fear and anger from past trauma. And this sounds a lot like what Steve Levin does with patients with post-traumatic stress disorder. And Steve says he's listing these here because enough people have told him they work, and even if they are, they only work according to a placebo effect. And he says some of the common power therapies are NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, TIR, traumatic incidence reduction, EFT, emotional freedom technique, and that involves tapping at different meridian points. And then EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which Dr. James Alexander uses extensively, and TFT, thought field therapy, and VKD, visuokinesthetic disassociation, And I went and researched these a little bit in my kind of simplified way. And emotional freedom techniques is a psychotherapeutic tool based on the idea that negative emotions are caused by disturbances in the body's energy field, and that tapping on the meridian while thinking of it, a negative emotion, alters the body's energy field, restoring its balance. And then eye movement desensitization and reprocessing is an information processing psychotherapy that was developed to resolve symptoms resulting from distressing memories. I guess that again is post-traumatic stress disorder. Then there's thought field therapy, which is associated with Roger Callahan. Proponents say they can heal a variety of mental and physical ailments through specialized tapping, which is similar, I guess, to emotional freedom technique. And then there's traumatic incident reduction is a form of therapy in which a technique is used to assist a patient suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder by reliving the experience in a controlled environment. Now that sounds very much like Peter Levin. And visual kinesthetic dissociation is adapted from visualization techniques developed by John Grinder and Richard Bandler, the co-founders of neuro-linguistic programming. It involves temporarily induced disassociation from the negative feelings associated with traumatic memory through visual review of the traumatic events from a different perspective, But Steve seems to think that programmed dreams, as practiced by Clancy McKenzie, can even be more effective than the power therapies. And that involves having a, well, he gives an example of a woman who was constantly racked with pain, who couldn't get over the death of her mother. And McKenzie had her dream of a situation where she went shopping with her mother and all of the pain resolved. And he says a lot of this has to do with a movement from separation to guilt to self-punishment and suffering. It's like a programmed dream is likened to a prayer, and then the problem is resolved in your sleep. So, and I know that of all of these power therapies, the one that's endorsed by the American Psychotherapeutic Association is EMDR. There, it's definitely proven to work. Now, all these others may or may not work because, as Steve says, they may elicit the placebo response. But, you know, six one or half dozen another, if they work. And I've heard a lot of reports. I wrote about that ballet dancer I knew who was getting bursitis after her divorce. And her mother is an EFT practitioner and worked with her, and now she's back dancing full blast. And she said that she was going to abandon her career. It had gotten so bad. So if they work, if the shoe fits, you know. And I've heard about this EMDR working by, well, the lady who developed it noticed that when she was out hiking, her eye movement was different when she closed her eyes in this new environment and then it was when she was in her normal day-to-day environment. And that seemed to break the association with the pain. It's like some kind of internal mental jujitsu that breaks your obsessive patterns. I guess that's just the way I take it, but I'm sure Herbie knows a lot more than I do about these power therapies.
It unlocks what's frozen. The power therapies I do, it will unlock what's frozen on inside, a traumatic experience, something that happened that you can't get out of your mind. A lot of times when people have something in their mind that they can't get out and it bothers them and they just can't let it go, like the PTSD people, you get in there, you know, in a matter of 5-10 minutes, you release that from them, then they're set free of a lot of emotional distress, anxieties, and a lot of times pain. That's what I've experienced, you know, and that's how it works on that part. So you can go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah, so has anybody else got anything to comment about these? This sounds very much like what Peter Levin does with post-traumatic stress disorder patients, where he unlocks the freeze response. He talks about a traumatic event creating a fight, flight, freeze, mammalian survival instinct response, but because of the interaction between the paleo-mammalian mind and the neo-mammalian mind, it gets frozen. And so he gets them to go back in and actually shake it off the way a zebra would after it's been, chased by a lion. And he says that's part of the problem of being human, is this relationship with the advanced part of the brain and its tendency to fixate on those frozen moments and keep them locked up. So, Herbie, how do you do this exactly?
Well,
it's
hard
this alone.
Yeah, to explain it's impossible. I mean, you just have to actually do it, you know. But on the other hand, I noticed that he talked about dreams in here, and that's something I don't know about. And if anybody wants to talk a little about dreams, I'd like to hear it. You know, I mean, I don't want to be like the Mr. Know-It-All on the phone here. I want to be able to try to help somebody. So, you know, still with the dreams. Anybody ever had success with dreams? You know?
What I've been noticing is what I've been practicing for about a week now is do a progressive relaxation while I'm first going to sleep, while I'm doing breathing exercises. And then I go back into a Buddhist deep breathing kind of exercise and ask about what my unconscious is doing. And then I put it out of my mind, and when I go to sleep, then I have noticed when I wake up in the morning, I will have dreams that I remember. Like that one I told you about last week where I was back in Denver 20 years ago at a place I used to hang out with a bunch of people. And I was with a girl I used to go out with there, except this big guy came along and took her off and stole her away. And after that, I turned to my right and there was my mother, except she was about 85 years old, just about ready to pass away. And I said, boy, I got to get out of here right now. And then I walked outside onto the sidewalk, and the car that I was waiting to get into to carry me away, the car that my mother had bought me, was not there. And so I got like triple abandonment by school, by girl, wow, by mother, death, separation. But I think that I would have to have a therapist to direct me about how to consciously control such a dream in order to get a resolution of this. And another dream I had in the interim was in the last week, a couple of nights ago, doing this technique, was I was floating in the ocean down by the beach, except it was back when I was about 20 when I used to surf. And I went around the corner from the sandy beach out where the rocks were, and someone warned me that there were sharks and told me that I should go out to him to where the danger was. And I said, no. And I went around the corner back to the sandy beach, and then the tide began to bring the water in, and it kept coming up and up. And I kept retreating up to the top, back to where my car was, so I could get away from its influence. And what this all means, but you can, it's obvious that if you do this kind of relaxation before sleep, you can summon up these dreams in a very palpable way. Now, think of all the symbolism of water and rebirth and danger and, you know, it's like a big mix of whatever state of mind you're in. You can read them. But how do you work them? That's my big question. You need to have a therapist there to give you direction, don't you?
Well, you got self-help therapies. You know, you got self-help therapies in NLP. You got self-help therapies in EFT, faster EFT. You got self-help therapies in the IFS model. You know, and you get together with peers that know what they're doing, that's been doing it probably for years, and they'll lead you and guide you, and next thing you know, you're having breakthroughs, and it's just awesome, and you just have to experience it. So, you know, like, it's something I could explain with, you know, I could get somebody with a negative memory right now on this phone and eliminate it in, like, 3 minutes. You'll still remember the memory. You'll still remember what you went through, but you won't have a negative charge to it. And it's just something that people need to experience so they can know that it's real. But at the same time, you know, it's something that you like for instance, Bruce, I'd say, okay, you know, you think about something that's bothered you in the past week or the past month, and then you think about it, you know? And when you think about it, I'd say, okay, now imagine if there's like a TV channel, like it's on the TV. And then you would turn the channel and watch the whole picture turn black and white, like that. And then when you did that in your mind, you'd have to see it. And then when you do it in your mind, I'd say, okay, now imagine that you're going to turn the channel again and it's going to turn yellow. And you're going to watch it turn yellow. And that's what you see, nothing but yellow. And you'll put
I've been releasing a lot of psychological content And I can see a lot of deeper meaning in all of this. And I also see how the unconscious is timeless. Because here I am back in Denver 20 years ago, and here's my mother just about to expire 10 years ago. Yeah. And here I'm back in Denver again at the same moment. And it's like all this content is held together in your mind in a kind of timeless state. But how would I formulate some kind of a program dream to take charge of this latent content? What should I think about when I go to bed?
Well, see, I don't know about the dreams, okay? I don't do that part. So that's why I said, does anybody on here know about dream work? And maybe they can help you there. You know, they can talk to you about it. But, you know, I mean, when I go to sleep, I tell myself something, and it usually happens. I'll dream about it, but I don't know how to go into that world, you know. I assume that's in the metaphysical world, too. So there's another therapy.
Yeah, Steve says that the stories of Dr. McKenzie's patients' healings are astounding, as healing emanates from enticing the mind to work through altered states of consciousness to allow answers to arise to awareness. Now, I'm certainly getting altered states of consciousness with this methodology I'm using before I go to sleep. But then how do you take charge of it? Where are the answers, you know? I mean, there are a lot of questions in all that stuff, but...
Hey, Bruce, it sounds like maybe you need to start dating a psychotherapist have her there when you're sleeping to do some dream work, you know? I mean, how else do you do that unless they have a couch and you fall asleep in their office or something, but I think it'd be cheaper just to date them or something.
Well, you do got the metaphoric mind, guys. You got the metaphoric mind. And what happens is when you're sitting there and you're speaking to somebody, a subject, it's a person, you know, and there's something going on, you could get them to really speak about just anything. And usually when you do that, they might tell you, you know, I saw this and I saw that. And everything that you see in those dreams, every bit of it, it's a metaphor to something that's happened in your life. It's a metaphor to
right.
something that might be happening.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, it's a metaphor. You know, the mind will show you metaphors. And all you have to do is just learn, you know, what those metaphors are meaning. So that's one of the ways I can explain to you how to figure out what's going on with your dream work.
Yes.
Hello?
Go ahead.
There's a man, his name is John Paul Jackson, and he has a lot online how to interpret dreams. He's very, very good. And sometimes, like, learning what the symbolism is in the dream is very helpful to help you, you know, to interpret what's going on in the dream. Because there's a lot written online about symbolism in dreams.
Oh,
and
yeah.
This one man, John Paul Jackson, he is excellent. Like, I have used, you know, his material to interpret some dreams, and it's very accurate if you want to check him out online.
And, well, this all goes way, way back to the cult of Asclepius in Greece, where you would go to the temple of Asclepius, the healing god, and you would pay the priest so much, give him a tithe, and you would spend the night in the temple in front of the altar where the statue of the god was, and the priest would give you some potion to drink, and if you were ill, you would go to the healing temple, and when you drank the potion, you'd go into a deep sleep, and you wake up, and the statue of the god would come alive. And he would come down
what
to
is
you
in that drink?
And tell you what you have to do. And when you'd wake up, you would be healed. And he'd send you off on some kind of a pilgrimage or something. You'd have to do this many sacrifices and so on. And the priest would be very intuitive, no doubt. Maybe the priest emerged in a get-up and while you were in this state did some psychotherapeutic work with you. But this tradition of the healing dream goes way, way, way back.
Yeah, and you get these guys that's been helping people for 20 years of their life, 20, 30, 50 years of their life. They learned, you know, just by stumbling upon instances how to help people. And, you know, a lot of times they'll get what they're calling now the reconsolidation process, and and it'll free people up. You know, I don't know about drinking something and seeing gods, but at the same time, you know, the metaphoric mind could see really anything, you know, whether you want to see it or not, it'll arrive, you know. Like, everybody's had a dream where you get up and in your mind you're like, what does that mean, you know? What does that dream mean? And we was going over some of this, remember, with the dogs in the other book we were studying. And we was trying to figure out, I mean, why did this lady keep dreaming, you know, about these dogs being their bellies eaten out, you know? I couldn't wrap my head around that, you know, not in a million years, because I don't study dream work. But at the same time, every bit of it meant something, you know. It did. It meant something.
And well, these were the people with the most repressed psychologies of all of Dr. Sarno's patients who had these really vivid dreams like that, that were filled with this, all you can call it is morbid imagery and morbid symbolism, you know, like cannibalism and animals eating each other, devouring each other. It's like out of a medieval romance or something, you know.
A medieval romance?
Oh, pretty, yeah, all these romances, you know, the Gawain and the Green Knight, and where the heroes have dreams and so on, when they're on the quest, on the romantic quest.
Well, one of the things I know about, you know, the power therapies is hypnotists are great at being able to take somebody that comes in, you know, say somebody comes in and they've been in pain a lot. And what they'll do is they'll start talking to them, you know, about kinesthetic talk, about the feelings, the emotions. You know, it must be a heavy burden on you. It must be like loading you down. And because that's through suggestive talk, right? And then the person will speak back and say, yeah, it's getting really heavy on me. This pain is real hard. You know, and then the hypnotist will know that the subject is in a kinesthetic mode, and that's it. And the thing the hypnotist needs to do and what he's trained to do is connect, is go ahead and keep speaking to them, but then bring up a visual for the person can go from feelings to seeing visuals. And talk to them a little bit about what they see in the visuals, and actually he's going to suggest what they need to see. You know, maybe it's a walk on the beach or seeing the sunshine or anything like that. And then they'll start experiencing those emotions and those feelings. And then that'll connect them to the visual part. And then you keep talking to them and you get them to hear what, you know, you get them to hear what they hear in this visual. Or you might even suggest to them what they need to hear. And when you get the visual part connected to the auditorial part, you know, the hearing connected to the sight, the visuals, well, then you just completed this person to where they was only in the feelings of the emotions, and they was in the emotional feeling the whole time. But what the hypnotist did, just while he was talking, not getting them under hypnotism or anything, he just connected the visual with the auditorial with the kinesthetic. It puts them back in balance. And that's one of the things hypnotists do that really makes them a success when they help people.
Mm-hmm.
Did that make sense? You know, I mean, if all you're doing is feeling pain all the time, you'll get to where, you know, the visuals you see or the things you hear, it's kind of a deletion. It won't be there to you much anymore. You know, your mind will be in the pain all the time. But
have to make them into symbols. You have to concretize the emotions, and then you have to extract the emotions again out of the symbols. It's like an unconscious process, turning them into the symbols, but then you have consciously deconstruct them
Yeah, you're doing it all while they're wide awake. I mean, it's not, you know, you don't even got to get them in a meditative state. Get them to relax a little, and then you just walk through it with them. And, hey, a lot of people, you know, come out feeling a lot better when they go see, you know, their hypnotherapist or whatever. I mean, it really helps them. To me, you know, and a lot of times they'll get a reconsolidation process just by connecting somebody, like, again, somebody that, you know, is in pain a lot of times, and then all they got is these feelings of these kinesthetic feelings, and they haven't probably saw a visual in their mind in years. And you get them to start seeing these, and it opens up new feelings in their body, new emotions, you know, and then you start hearing the sounds that you're suggesting, and then they start hearing that. Next thing you know, they start feeling awesome. And if they can keep that going throughout the week, it'll keep the week going really great for them. And a lot of times it helps relieve pain.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. I've read this book several times. It's called The Anatomy of a Miracle by Dr. Jim Richards. It's really not about miracles. It's more about the science of belief. And this book is like amazing. This man had kidney disease in the last stage. And his doctor said, there's nothing we can do for you. So what he did was he did all this research, and he decided was that he was going to link his belief to live with being an emotional positiveness. And he talked a lot about visualization, and that it's so important to really go deep within your heart to see what beliefs in your heart are stopping you from getting to that end point. Like, he needed to go deep in his heart to see, like, you know, how he was going to get to be healed. And he does get healed. Like, it's amazing. And he said once, like, he gives this example that he goes to the doctor's office to get his, I guess, urine tested. And when he gets there, he starts to he starts to sense, like, the odor, like, you know, that although it wasn't in a hospital, like, hospital kind of odor, and he starts to, like, fear starts to rise up in him. So when he gives his urine to get checked, it's all positive. So they say, we have to admit you right now to the hospital. So he's in the hospital, and he says, okay, how did this happen? I've been doing so well. And he realizes it's his emotions. So he says, well, if those emotions got me in here, I'm going to start changing them while I'm in here to change my body's chemistry again to whatever was in his urine. So he does that, and he starts to realize that his thinking along with his emotions can change his body chemistry. So
he
has all,
like Norman Cousins, incidentally.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot. It's a little deeper than, like, he has all these amazing people that he does talk about a lot. What is her name? Candice Pert.
Yes, Candice Pert.
Yeah, like, he has all these wonderful people that he quotes in there and their research. And it's really, it's the most motivating book, because he just keeps encouraging to see the end, to see the end result, to keep on seeing the end result no matter what. Bring your mind back to the end result. No matter how much frustration, how much doubt, just keep bringing your mind back the picture of the end result. And he said that you know, he really believes that really helps in all healings. But it's an excellent read. I mean, you won't be able to stop. It's called The Anatomy of a Miracle by Jim Richards. It's such a good read. It's really motivated me to make sure to, you know, have a constant check on what I'm thinking. He talks a lot about thoughts and how powerful they are and how they control the DNA cell, you know, the DNA of the cell. It's a wonderful book.
Downside I see to, unfortunately, we live in an age where science doesn't recognize miracles, or at least the science on the 6 o'clock news doesn't. I think there's a lot of miracles happening, but the era we live in is so scientifically oriented. If there isn't a scientific explanation for it, it doesn't exist. Therefore, reporters on the 6 o'clock news aren't out there sending their trucks, satellite trucks, to sites where miracles have reportedly taken place. That's the age we live in, unfortunately, where God, it's, I guess, predominantly a godless age, generally speaking, culturally, for Western culture. So I'm all for miracles.
Yeah, this book, this,
this is more than just a miracle, though.
I believe.
Yeah, this book really deals a lot with the science. Like, the, it's more, it says miracles, but it's really about the science of believing and what it does in your body, that. But I know I watched a video recently, and it was about this woman. Her name is Dahlia Knox, and she was paralyzed for 22 years. I don't know how I got to this YouTube. I'm always looking up things, but I got to this YouTube and I saw a woman healed who was paralyzed 23 years. I thought, oh, I'm gonna watch this. And it was so interesting. Talk about miracles. This was a miracle. I never witnessed a miracle. So, well, I don't want to say that, but this is an amazing miracle. And she went to this church service, and she wasn't going to get healed or anything. She just went in this church service. And she said that what happened was that there was a little baby who was going to die, and she just started, like, saying, oh, God, you have to heal the baby, you have to heal the baby. And as she was saying that, she said that something happened in her. And before she knew it, they were wheeling her up to get prayed for, and they prayed for her, and she starts feeling... She just, like, starts, I don't know what, because it doesn't have a sound, but she just, like, has her hands up, and all of a sudden she tries to stand out of the wheelchair. It is the most amazing video. So she's trying to stand, and then it says that she has starting to have sensations in her legs. She gets up, like, she falls back down, and she keeps doing this, get up, falls down. Well, she winds up walking, and... After 23 years of being paralyzed, she was totally healed, and that was like, so miracles do happen, because this was the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life.
Well, you don't have to have a theoretical or a metaphysical explanation for such things if you can get science to admit that emotions affect biology, which is what Bruce Lipton is all about. What Candace Pert is all about.
Right.
Just making that jump from breaking down the mechanical metaphor behind, attacking the mechanical metaphor behind modern science, coming up with a new way of explaining these things. You don't have to talk about Asclepius coming to you in the night and healing you. If you can admit that emotions can actually affect your cellular structure. And that seems to be the point of this chapter 33 of Laugh, Damn It, Seriously. That's what Steve is all about in here, is the fact that, and of course what Norman Cousins is all about. Laughter suppresses the release of the stress hormone and immune system suppressor cortisol, boosting the immune system's power. Laughter also releases endorphins and natural painkillers into the spinal canal. The endorphins generate a sense of peace and happiness and pleasure, an analgesic effect that alters mood, relieving depression, and boosting disease fighters. All good stuff. Worry demands control, and laughter is losing control. And it seems like that's what Norman Cousins did by watching all those Marx Brothers and looking at life from an ironic, humorous perspective. He changed his biology.
Right. I so believe that. I so believe that. I so believe that. I had
you don't need a deus ex machina. You don't need a god coming down from heaven on a cart. When you can do it yourself, maybe that is a theological concept. I don't know. Once you admit that body and mind are linked, then you all of these false dark dichotomies of spirit, and matter fall apart.
Mouse Mom, are you still on the phone?
Yep, I'm here.
What do you think about all this?
I don't know yet.
Do you think emotions can change, you know, even your DNA? I mean, people believe your emotions can change your DNA.
Oh, yeah. No, I totally believe. I just got done reading Lisa Raikin's book, Mind Over Medicine, and she quotes a lot of things in there, too. So I do believe in a lot of that.
And what was her book about?
A lot of the same concepts with TMS that we've all kind of heard, but she brings up a lot of studies. She was a OBGYN doctor herself.
Right. I've heard of her, yes.
Yeah. She's had some big PBS specials and whatnot. But, she's a good, good read. It was an easy read. Just another perspective on the mind-body.
Yeah, I know I have a girlfriend who, I think it was like 10 years ago, she had ovarian cancer and breast cancer at the same time. Can you imagine? And
phase 4. That's
yeah. So the thing is that she decided she was not going to do the chemotherapy route. She had a hysterectomy and she had a lump taken out of her breast. But she went to some clinic. I think it was in Nevada, and she did the tapping. They did a bunch of things, but what she felt like. Spending time there, she said she learned it from just listening to herself and listening to her body, that there was a key to her healing. And she felt the key that she had some, bitter emotions and unforgiveness toward her husband. And as she started clearing that stuff out, she totally recovered. Like, it was pretty amazing. Like, she wouldn't talk to anybody because she didn't want to hear anything negative. And she did that. Is it EFT, the tapping? She did the tapping. And she still does the tapping today. And she got this machine, that changes your body frequencies. And she, because that's what they used there in this clinic in Nevada. And it was the most wonderful healing story. And, she did get, it's been 10 years now. So that was very, very, like, very encouraging. Like, she felt that her emotions got her into this, with this cancer.
It's interesting what you say about EFT being a cure, because James Alexander in The Hidden Psychology of Pain talks about EFT, and he says this suggests a relationship between the stimulation of acupuncture points and the activation of particular areas of the brain. It is thought that the semiconductive properties of the body's connective tissue allow acupuncture stimulation to rapidly send electromagnetic signals to specific areas of the body and brain. So this healing procedure that your friend or this woman went through sounds like it involves that, especially when you start talking about the wavelengths, this machine. I've seen such a machine. I actually know a guy who uses these for cancer patients, and it's highly illegal. If they caught him using this, he'd be in big trouble.
Right.
I've seen the machine, too.
What is it, Bruce?
Oh, it's like an electric stimulator.
Okay.
It puts, frequencies in the room. You could put it on your body, but, she's brought her machine over, and she... It like, oh my gosh, once she put it on my body, I felt like I was like being electrocuted. But it's like, it sends, like, it changes the frequencies in the room and supposedly in your body that change. I do believe that sometimes, like, pain happens because the frequencies in our body, like, something is blocked or, it's not running smoothly. It's like the river in us isn't running smoothly. So, and a lot of times it has to do with emotions. I don't know if anyone has ever read that book. I've looked at it. I haven't read it all. It's Feelings Buried Alive. It's called Feelings Buried Alive, and there's some other part of the book. But it's about that, like when you bury your feelings and you don't, like, repressed emotions, how it causes, you know, different medical problems. Oh, Feelings Buried Alive Never Die. Did anyone ever hear that book?
I've heard of it.
Yep.
Yeah, because that's a book my girlfriend used. She used that book a lot. Like, she read through it, and she felt it was very helpful.
Well, awesome. Steve seems to think that self-pity, guilt, anger, and victimization strengthen the neural sets, forming nerve cell identity. Laughter breaks these hardwired neural sets and begins rewiring new neural relationships with happier, more fun, and pleasurable small peptide chains. It doesn't sound like you need to have these complicated interventions from electronic devices so much as changing your own biology via emotions, like humor. In the case of chapter 33, maybe all of this apparatus that people go through just reinforce, it gives them a physical quasi-scientific mechanism to hang on to. But they're really doing something different. They're doing something with their emotions while they're going through this procedure. And that is, in effect, rewiring their neural pathways.
Well, someone recently told me that with your mindset, like, that every time you you stop a negative thought and you replace it with a positive thought, what you're doing is you're shutting down those neural pathways of pain.
Yes.
And you're creating new neural pathways. So I think that is very scientific, that, you know, like that you know, I know that I haven't been laughing a lot lately, and I really need to do that. But I do try to watch all any negative thoughts that come to me, like, you're not getting better, you know, this has lasted so long, and I try to shut those, you know, I try to not go into that, so it makes so much negative, you know, emotions in me, because I don't think that is good.
Well, I think the key word is alternative neural pathways. Because I gather that the pain pathways are there, pretty much they're locked in forever, but you've got to find strategies for developing these alternative pathways that will override them, that will become preferred.
Well, I thought what Dr. Schrubiner said, that you could shut down those pathways. Like, they're there, but you kind of, like, shut them down. Yeah, I don't know a lot about that, so I don't really either.
We're getting fascinated.
It's really fascinating.
Getting where dragons dwell. Because we can speculate about scientific proof for these things, but there really isn't, is there, for us?
I mean, I think we can relate science to what we're doing. So one example of that might be with James Alexander. Looks at a lot of the power therapies, not all of the power therapies, but at least some of them, and ties them to some recent neuroscientific research about how memories are formed and stored and either changed or just locked in our brains. And I never used to think that memories had much to do with TMS until I started reading about this, and I realized that if we study learning in the brain, that's what healing is. Healing is a form of learning. Healing is a form of forgetting. Healing is a form of change. So can we relate that to the neuroscience? I'm not sure, but it does seem that in contemporary brain science, there's a great deal of emphasis on brain plasticity, meaning plastic just means change. So brain plasticity just means that the mind can change, and there's a heavy emphasis on these learned nerve pathways, which I think is what was being described. I will confess, I was also in the chat room. We have a gentleman in the chat room, and I've been kind of moderating over there. But that was the sense that I got from from what was being discussed in the voice channel. Did that answer your question?
Oh yes, thank you.
Okay, good.
Yeah, that was good. That is good.
You were talking about, did I get that right, that you were talking about learned nerve pathways and how they relate? And
yeah, I'm fascinated with that. I mean, I was reading the next chapter in Steve O's book, what is it, 34? And like and he talks a lot about the brain. I don't know all the parts, but how he was saying like repetition, like changes, and your brain has an aha experience, and then it shuts down. I believe he said, like, it just shuts down the pain pathways. I don't know if he used that word, but it was really, I said, oh, my gosh. And it just so spoke to my heart. I was like, yes. He was saying how fear, like, is promoted in the brain and that it has to shut down the fight or flight and the autonomic nervous system and that, you know, Sarno's method of, you know, knowledge and keep reading and keep reading. What you're doing is like you're getting it in the conscious and then it goes deeper into, I don't know what part of the brain, and then you have like that aha experience. And he was explaining that some people, I think they were the left brainers, they sometimes could read the book and get it right away, where the right brainers can't. So I thought, I was very fascinated with that because I'm always amazed, like, someone like I'm reading, like, oh my gosh, this person just read the book and they get totally healed. And I'm like, here, I'm like, oh my gosh, like, what's wrong with me?
Well, I think that you are in the majority, that most people, absolutely most people, they don't heal quickly. It takes a very long time but it takes much longer than overnight for the vast majority of people.
Have you heard, because I know that, like, my symptoms have, really, I'd say since October, have really revved up.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's because I saw a TMS doctor to definitely get it confirmed. And then mm-hmm. I started to really work on different issues and, different past things about my marriage and different things. And I feel that since I started doing that, the symptoms have been moving and intensified and I think that's because they're just trying to distract me because I'm getting into core issues.
Yeah, that is a core question. I think that is such a fascinating question, and I don't feel like I have an answer. I mean, I know lots of people, they come on the site, and they start going into this deep work, and then sometimes, you know you've hit some sort of a nerve because they get worse. And obviously, lots of times, they get better. And so, I mean, it's an open question about how much those things need to be pursued. And so I generally just trust the person in question to figure it out. I think that's something that you need to think about. You need to look at how you feel as you're reviewing these things. Think about how you feel as you think about them. Listen to your own felt sense and then say, okay, are these things that I need to explore more or not? I mean, sometimes I'm also sympathetic to the view that the more we review these traumatic memories from our past, the more we almost allow them to re-injure us. And so I think that to some degree, the idea of taking those negative thoughts and then replacing them with a positive one is actually very, very positive. So I brought up James Alexander before, and Herbie actually brought up this idea of reconsolidation before. Mm-hmm. James Alexander is a PhD. He's a TMS psychologist from
right.
Australia. And he talks about this idea of reconsolidation. And the key idea of reconsolidation is that if you have a memory that's hurting you, you go back and you feel that thing, and then you feel an opposite feeling. So you don't remember something that traumatized you and then feel the same feeling over again, because that will make the memory stronger. Rather, you go back and feel the thing which re-traumatized you, and then you feel safe. So I think it's important to have that balance.
Oh, that sounds really good. So
yeah.
What you do, you go back and you feel like you might cry, you may feel angry, and then you replace it with, like, can you give me an example?
Absolutely. I think then you replace it with a positive thought. So I think that it depends on which therapeutic approach you're doing. So NJOY is a big fan of internal family systems. And in internal family systems, you have something that you're working on which causes you pain. You go back, you kind of make contact with it. But rather than kind of enraging that part of you, you treat it with respect. You recognize that it's trying to protect you, and you calm it down. You soothe it, so that if you're angry at someone, you see the part of you that's angry at the person, and then you listen to why they're angry at that person, and then you try to reason with them, and you listen to them, and you give that part of you space, and that's all a way to calm that part of you down. So rather than mulling it over and building your and saying, oh, this person messed me up and really hurt me and it's not fair, and you just kind of whip yourself up into more and more of an anger, you say, okay, why am I feeling this way? Is this anything that I really have any control over? And is it good for me to be angry at them? Maybe you try to see it from their perspective, not because you're nice to them, but just because you want to be nice to yourself. And you use that as a way to diffuse the emotion instead of letting it build.
Right.
Up.
Oh, that's good.
Can I insert something here for us?
Sure.
About IFS? Yeah, you got it pretty straight, all right. The only thing I would add is that you recognize that the parts of you are not the total you, that there really is, it's not a part, but there really is a real you who can kind of moderate all these feelings that you've got going on inside. When you call it a part, you could also call it a feeling, you could call it an opinion. It's just that you haven't processed yet. And so if you process it, you bring it into the real you, who is, sensible and mature and all that good stuff. And it becomes an asset rather than a liability. So that's basically it. You just go in, you talk to the part, you say, gee, thanks for trying to help me. I really appreciate it. You know, tell me all about it. Well, is there anything I can do for you? How about letting me handle this instead of punching somebody in the nose when they make you mad? How about if I deal with it? And oftentimes, in fact, almost all the time, it'll say, sure, go ahead. Yeah, it didn't know that you were there. It thought it had to punch somebody in the nose when it was mad.
That's so good.
And so that's an example of...
It's just opinion. It's not you.
You make contact with that part,
yeah.
And then, but rather than revving it up, you cool it down. And
that's right.
Part of that model of these learned nerve pathways, where you really want to add these happier pathways to your life rather than adding these angry pathways to your life, or these sad pathways, or these weak feeling pathways, or the scared pathways. You want to do the powerful pathways, the compassionate pathways.
Well, really,
right.
What usually happened is that you were about 2 years old the first time you felt this feeling, and you're still kind of like a little kid. So you have to, you have to invite that part of you to kind of grow up. And it'll do it. It's not trying to cause trouble. It's just trying to help.
It seems like these programmed dreams that Clancy McKenzie advocates is a way to get back to those frozen moments and break them up actively and break up that unconscious guilt. It's almost like a neural pathway that's frozen, that's usually developed due to one of those Holmes Rahi events, the things that go from guilt to self-blame when you're separated, when somebody dies, the loss of a significant love, so on. It seems like that's like an active kind of intervention that the therapist in McKenzie's system performs. He unfreezes it when you're in this dream state where everything's plastic, and you can access it directly. If you've been given a if he's giving you this kind of mantra or this set of instructions for breaking up that, is that, that almost seems like you're doing something physiological too at the same time. You're creating an alternative pathway through direct intervention in a dream state under the direction of a psychotherapist.
Bruce, can I ask you something?
Sure.
Where do you find this stuff? Is it Silva Method you're talking about?
I'm taking it right out of Chapter 32 on power therapies, and I'm talking about programmed dreams.
I couldn't see a direct reference to where you could find out more about this, because this sounds very sensible to me. It would be a way of down parts, too.
Yeah, it's like a practical way to do it without going through a lot of brouhaha. It's direct intervention in the unconscious, isn't it?
Steve-O mentions Bruce McKenzie in the chapter we're reading. I found that pretty fascinating, and I'd like to learn more about Bruce McKenzie since Steve-O says it works fantastically. So it'd probably be worth something pursuing more Bruce McKenzie.
I think it's Silva Method. I Googled it, and I came across a book which I downloaded, but it's not specifically about programmed dreams. It's by McKenzie, though. But from what I can see from what I Googled, the Silva Method uses this. I have a friend who recommended the Silva Method a lot of years ago, but I've never really looked into it. It's pretty old.
I think in the dreams I've been having, what I want is a handle, is some kind of instruction for how to directly intervene in that unconscious state. I guess a magician could do this, someone who's really got their will developed. It's almost like I don't know how I can do that while I'm asleep.
Me either. But I'd like to learn.
I can remember when I was a kid having dreams where I would take charge. I can, or I'd start to control them. But now. I get all this latent psychological content, and I can interpret it for days and write reams about it. But as far as actively intervening in the content and changing it, I think you would need a really astute psychotherapist to work with. Give you some direction.
Why, Bruce? Why? You seem like, you are a very intelligent man. Why would you need a psychotherapist to help you with that?
Step one, to objectify.
I don't understand what that means.
Someone to serve as an objective other to bounce your thought off against, so you're just not lost in all of this latent content and fascinated with it, as fascinating as it is. Someone who would say, do this. You know, when you get into this situation, take charge. Give you a task. Yeah, a taskmaster. I guess you could figure it out yourself, but it would be a lot slower. You couldn't predict the kind of dreams that would be coming up, could you? Like McKenzie gave this lady instructions to dream of a nice time with her mother out shopping. And that defused the whole situation. He interpreted what was going on as an objective other in this psychotherapeutic relationship with his client and gave her instructions. It sounds like that would work better than doing it on your lonesome, you know, or quicker anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. D. McKenzie, M.D., and he is connected with Silva Method. He was the psychiatric consultant to the Silva Method from 1971 to 1999. Or something like that. So that's a clue. I'd like to know more about this. This sounds like fun.
It does. It sounds interesting to me.
Was that called the Silva method of mind control? It's like I heard something.
Yeah, that's the
one.
Yeah,
forgotten
okay,
into it.
Cool.
The seminars and stuff, and I live way out in the bush, and I'm not going to any seminars. So, but anyway, here we go. There's the McKenzie method. Oh ho. Okay. So yeah, this is if you Google it, you'll find drmckenzie.com.
Hey, definitely. Yeah. Definitely sounds like worth pursuing, McKenzie.
Yeah.
I got to write a note on that because Sivo really recommended him highly. And I know my girlfriend, she really dreams a lot. I mean, she's tuned into her dreams. I mean, I don't normally remember dreams. It seems like the dreams I remember are nightmare dreams, so I don't really concentrate. But she's in her sleep. She is thinking about... She has an overview of her dreams, and in the morning she says, "Boy, I had this dream. I got it." But lately, something interesting that occurred to me—an interesting personal phenomenon—is that I've had three dreams about running, and I can't run. I used to run marathons. I can't run anymore. I limp. I can't. My arthritis, TMS / whatever it is, has gotten so bad I can't bend over and tie my right shoe anymore. So I found it just interesting that I'm dreaming about running. I'm hoping that is a good sign for TMS healing eventually.
It is.
Thank you. All right.
It is. It's a real good sign. Keep saying it.
He just kept thinking about running all the time, and he would keep thinking about himself running without pain, and he would just focus on that, and eventually it came true. Just with that creative visualization. It sounds like you're trying to do that. Or
yeah, I'd love to. I used to be fast. Yeah, who was that, Bruce? Bruce, I didn't catch who you're talking about.
Oh, Steve was talking about it. That was his healing chapter.
Steve, okay, thank you.
Steve, he kept thinking about running all the time, no matter how much it hurt. He'd keep imagining himself running smooth, pain-free, and fast. And eventually it came true.
Yeah, he's a great inspiration but of hope and faith. But reading his book when he had his wife beat him with a bat or whatever he did. Seems like most people, including myself, are going to, you know, not go that far unless they've heard that will do the trick. After reading Steve-O say, "That's the amount of pain you have to go through," I said, "Okay, I'm willing if that'll do it." You know, so I keep putting one foot in front of the other. But I think in this age, most people are not going to go there unless they read someone like Steve-O or have a guide who says, "Yeah, that's what it's going to take. You have to break through. You're going to have to be able to withstand some excruciating pain." And I don't think most people will do that because they don't think that's what they need to do.
Yeah, well, Steve really did it for us all. I remember telling him you were a test bed for TMS theory. And he was saying, yeah. He pushed everything about as far as you could take it. That's the real radical approach, going to the root of things and never letting up. But I don't think most people want to go that far. But thanks to his example, he broke some ground, didn't he?
Yeah, well, most people don't know that's how far you got to go. And I think Steve's case, he had some excruciatingly bad experience, your wife being paralyzed. I mean, his experience was really bad, so maybe that's why. But he had pain before he got married. He had pain, I think he said, 27 years. So to me, the Steve-O's genius is the hope and faith that he gives others that even 27 years of back pain and stuff, other stuff, you can heal, and that's the genius. But unless you read someone like Steve-O, you don't know that is possible.
Yeah, he does establish potential, doesn't he? It's like...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, as I said, somewhere I said, imagination precedes accomplishment. He had the imagination that a lot of us lack. And he pushed it as far as you could.
If you can't dream it, you can't do it.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I looked up a couple of books by this McKenzie guy, and the one that I've downloaded, it's on Kindle, is called Babies Need Mothers, and it's about...
That's
what I've been... Well, actually, I'm kind of upset right now, because basically his premise is that mothers have schizophrenia in children, and I have a schizophrenic daughter, and I'm perfectly willing to take... responsibility, if that's what it is, but you know, it's just up to me, the idea, because mainstream medicine has been telling me, oh no, it's just genetic and it's blah blah, it's this and that, you know, for so long.
All the psycho killers always blame their mom.
Yeah, no, I know, and it's sort of it's sort of something I've been through a lot with, so I kind of freaked out, and I actually got that out of this chapter while I was preparing for this. Anyway, I looked up another book that this guy's written. It's called Delayed Post-Traumatic Stress Disorders from Infancy, The Two Trauma Mechanism. So now what I want to do is...
He's the guy who came up with the two trauma mechanism, Dad.
What's that?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that would be really fertile reading. That's what all of Peter Levine's work is based on. Basically, and for that matter, Gabor Mate too. Everybody rests with one foot on this McKenzie's two trauma theory.
Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? I'd like to know more about it, because I mean, I had my mother wasn't a mother. I don't know why I grew up. And I don't think I was a good mother to my daughter. In fact, I left that basically to my husband, and we also had a young son who just adored her. I thought she would be okay, but she's not okay, not at all. But it's a sad thing, you know, to explore. And it's like someone who was talking about feeling... with a lot of pain to go over this. I think I get over this stuff. Yeah, I think you really have to, including facing, everything that you might have done to contribute to someone else's pain. So, yeah.
Okay, that sounds like it's covered a lot of power therapies. Anybody want to say anything on laughter?
I'm just wondering what all the crashing and banging is about. Does anybody know? It's really loud.
Sounds like paper shuffling.
Yeah. Is that you
I'm
again,
Herb? No, I am not shuffling any papers.
I think that's me. I've been shuffling papers. I apologize. I didn't realize it could be heard over the mic. So, okay, laughter. So I'm going to laugh that one off. I apologize. But there's in India, there are groups that get together to laugh, because
the
Indians
in British Columbia. Go
we could all do it on here right now, and you just start laughing.
It's called laughter.
Yeah,
start laughing,
yeah,
right, Tom?
Yeah,
start laughing.
You
can start laughing. For real, that's the way you do it, everybody. Everybody starts laughing. Next thing you know, you're just full of laughter. And Tom just started doing, and then I start doing it with him, and then enjoy you start laughing, and then everybody starts laughing. Next thing you know, you just start feeling good.
Yeah, exactly. Cheers you up.
Yeah. So regarding that, when my mother was dying, not from cancer, kidney cancer, but from the side effects of the bad operation. In perspective, I think, given if she would have been her own will, she might have beaten the cancer, but the kindly oncologist said, no way, you got to have the surgery, and the surgery eventually did kill her, but it took 9 months in ICU to do that. I did a lot of research about cancer and about healing, and read a lot of Bill Moyers and his tapes, his PBS series, and Dr. Bernie Siegel, and stuff like that, and I remember one thing definitely was recommended, that musicals are good for people who are healing. And I just remember Oklahoma, I think, is my favorite musical. I just brought her all these. In the hospital, they had a cart with a TV and a VCR, so I'd roll it in there every time I visit her, and rent videos of musicals like Oklahoma, et cetera. It didn't do her any good. It was too far gone by then. She had 13 tubes of her, and the surgeons had done lots of their job there. But I learned a lot from it. And also Pachelbel. Apparently listening to Baroque music, especially Pachelbel, is supposed to be very healing. The rhythm of that is supposed to be very good for healing. So Oklahoma and Pachelbel if you want to heal.
Well, you've got to realize that during the 1930s, when everybody was really down and out, that was the golden age of comedy in the United States, because people were hungry and they came into the theaters for those free meals, all you could eat lunches. They were trying to entice people into the theaters. And what was the fare? Laurel and Hardy, Max Sennett. It is a great healing tool. It's a distraction. Not only a distraction, it also changes your biochemistry. It must have taken their mind off of being so hungry and worried.
It changes your emotional chemistry, the emotions of your body, the polyneuropeptides. They maybe drop off of the spot where maybe they get laughed off of the pain spot and move on to somewhere else, and hopefully out your colon or somewhere like that, to the sewage plant. And
Steve says the laughter boosts the immune system's power. Well, thus it is like a power therapy, isn't it? You can see why these two chapters go back to back. Where there's the power therapies, and then there's guided dreams, and then Steve says, "Well, here's one that just works without any of this fall-to-all, without any of this guided imagery or intervention from a therapist. You can just do it yourself." He talks a lot about moving from, he talks about that that book on Parseval, and it sounds very much like the same thing that William Blake was interested in, moving from innocence. In the Songs of Innocence and Experience, you move from innocence to experience, and something's lost and something's gained, and then you move on to radical innocence, Blakean radical innocence. That's when you get back to Jerusalem, to the New Jerusalem, when you've integrated both. And a lot of Blake is laughter. Finally, he reaches that point. A lot of the great poets have gone through their tragic phases, and if they live long enough, they get to this new state of mind, this radical innocence, where they laugh at the world.
Yeah. Well, corollary to that, I mean, look at the cultural, I can't call it cultural fare, what you see in movies. I haven't been to a movie in years because I personally believe Hollywood is just creating 90% of what it's doing is garbage. And just, I mean, the Hunger Games and children are seeing grotesque. I think Hollywood is conditioning us to whatever this terrible future is going to be through. Right now, we're being mentally conditioned to see awful images, the NCIS shows, the depictions. And you know, when I was a kid, you never saw stuff like that on television. It's too gruesome. People had some common sense, but now that's all you seem to get, 90% from Hollywood and TV, is gruesome images. And what are they conditioning us for? If people wanted to laugh in the Great Depression, what's the entertainment of today telling us about our era?
But we're just still working up to that in North America, and so I think people are processing their fear. That's my impression. And also, I mean, kids are naturally inclined, and a lot of adults too are naturally inclined to scaring themselves off to death as a way of not really thinking about serious issues. So, you know, it's too bad that it's like it is, but we're going through that kind of a period in history. There's not much we can do about it.
Well, I can do so. I'm not supporting it. Like I said, I haven't been to a movie theater in 15 years because I am not supporting the garbage Hollywood is putting out there. They should be ashamed of themselves. They are there are some sick people out there who actually use these as templates for creating crimes. Your normal person is not a psychopath. Yeah, but I think Hollywood has a great culpability in what's happening today in our culture and the crime that's happening, and maybe the overall negativity of people's outlooks. And after they maybe they have to go back to creating. Are there musicals anymore? Has there been a musical in the last decade?
I don't know.
The Sound of Music.
You know, one of the things that really helped me a lot, you know, with the laughter point, is Walt had sent me some old movies on DVDs from the 40s, from 1937, 1947, and Henry Fonda. I think some people on here remember Henry Fonda, and it was called The Lady Eve, and if you was to watch it compared to movies nowadays, you think, you know, you would just think it was awesome because the whole time they're really telling more through their body language than just words. And basically, when I was coming through fighting off this tick bite that I went through last year, I mean, I'd gotten deathly sick, and I just decided to use laughter and, you know, and see how it worked. And I sit there and watch those old movies. I laughed, and I didn't pay attention to nothing else. I didn't focus on any hurtful thoughts or anything. I just kept my mind on good thoughts, and I laughed. And within a week, I was up, getting my strength back, and it was phenomenal. My doctor couldn't believe I was recovering that quick, and I was. And I attribute, you know, a lot of that from sitting there and just watching those old time, you know, comedies from that many years ago, and it really did a lot for me.
That's so cool, Herbie.
Yeah.
Thanks for reminding us of that. That's so cool that you did that, like Norman Cousins.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just like Norman Cousins. Yeah.
Yeah.
I noticed when I was involved in a contract. I was a long way from home, and I was living in executive housing, and I had to work like 12 hours a day every day on Saturday and Sunday. When I come home and I turn on Homer Simpson, I would just laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh. There was no humor in my life whatsoever, just this onerous project. But when that would come on, it would strike a responsive nerve, and I just would laugh uncontrollably, like I imagine I wouldn't right now. It was because I'd been repressing all of those feelings all day long, so I'd see the humor in it. It was like a real relief. It really helped me do my work.
I wonder if this is something that we should recommend on the forum more. I mean, should we be prescribing Laurel and Hardy on the forum more? I mean, just... Y'all need to get out there and laugh a little bit. I think there's probably some truth to it. I mean, maybe we really need to communicate that to people.
Yeah, I listened to Walt. I went on YouTube and watched all those classic old Laurel and Hardys. The Delivery Man with the piano, where it keeps falling down the stairs. And then the policemen arrest them for doing their job, for trying so hard.
Maybe we need a laughter sub-forum, you know, like a...
good idea.
Yeah, you can get all those Laurel and Hardy movies on YouTube.
And there's books and there's magazine articles. It's, it's stuff. My problem with old movies, my husband loves to watch old movies, but I know what those days were really like, you know, for a lot of people. and it's not as neat as it is, but I think what you have to do is find out what's funny for you and watch more of it, you know, stick with it. Yeah.
Steve Martin in The Jerk, yeah, or Airplane, or There's a lot of good more recent movies. Anything with Mel Brooks or Gene Wilder. There's a lot of Animal House. There's a lot of movies you can watch once a year, every year, and just laugh your butt off.
There's Ashley Brilliant. I mean, does anybody remember him? Like, the guy is an absolute archetype. You know, there's all kinds of stuff. That would be great for us. We need the subforum so we can all contribute what's funny for us. And
I'll make it.
Share that.
I'll make it right now.
Yeah. You.
That's great. Well, guys, this has been a great show. What do you think?
Yeah. It's like Steve said, worry demands control. Laughter is losing control. And people who have TMS have these really well-developed, overdeveloped superegos that are always trying to control things.
Mm-hmm.
And laughter goes against that, doesn't it? Laughter breaks that down.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I was so serious for so many years. I was just, you know, I was a preacher. I mean, there was so many other things that you're supposed to, you know, be so serious about. And I just fell into that area to where I don't remember a period to where I just laughed, you know, just for the fun of it. And I brought that back into my life when I almost died last year, and it really opened my eyes to laughter. It was awesome. We can get so serious, you know, because of TMS. The first thing most of us do when we get it, we think we're never going to get rid of this pain. We think we're going to have it the rest of our lives. We hear all this terrible stuff from our doctors. And I'm not saying, you know, anything bad about docs. I mean, they do the best they can do. But at the same time, there's higher truths. There's more knowledge out there than just what they know. There's more knowledge out there than just what we know. There's knowledge out there that can help you, and that's the whole point of what we're talking about here, especially with power therapies and laughter, and it doesn't have to be a miracle. It'll feel like a miracle. It'll seem just like a miracle when it happens, but at the same time, this is well thought out, you know, stuff that people has learned over the years, and they develop it into these therapies that works, that really helps change people over a matter of hours, days, weeks, other than years, you know. So that's how they work.
Good summary, Harvey.
Yeah, and they're really good. Okay, guys, that's it. I think Bruce ended it with a powerful thing there about TMS, and so many of us just getting so serious, we just don't laugh no more, and we need to learn to laugh more. It is healing. So,
well, in the service of that, we now have a new subforum called "Laughter is the Best Medicine." So I expect you all to go there and post your favorite funny YouTube videos.
Okay, great. I'll make sure to post some great videos in there because I see them all the time. I make sure I try to laugh. You got what, Enjoy?
I said, I've got some slam poetry online. Probably shock your socks off, but I think it's funny.
Right.
Okay. Well, that's great, guys. Anybody else want to add anything? Okay. Well, that's the end of the show for tonight.
Bye, all.
Thanks, guys. It's been awesome.
Thank you, Herbie.
Thank you,
buddy. Good night. Thanks.
Thank you, Mouse Mom.
Bye.
Thank you, Enjoy. Thank you, Tennis Tom.
Bye. Thank you. Welcome.
All right. Thanks for laughing with me, buddy.